Thanks, Rick. Well, it was 1620, and they were rogues, all of them. Bacon, Descartes, Boyle, Cassini, underground, revolutionary, anti-establishment. Sorry about that. It was a time of revolution. It was a time of change. And they were using and inventing new tools to look at the world. The microscope, the thermometer, the telescope, the barometer. New tools and new ways of looking at the world. And most importantly, they had a new way of looking at the world. They had mathematics. They were inventing mathematics. They were coming up with things like the calculating machine. They were coming up with things like the slide rule. Things that advanced our way of understanding the world, advanced our way of looking at the world. What they had that people before them didn't have was the idea that the world could be measured. And measured not just in the sense of it takes 5 days to go from Jerusalem to Damascus, but measured in a way of looking at the world as though the world were a series of points, as though we could think of the world as an agglomeration, a conglomeration of individual entities, of atoms, of objects, if you will. The revolution of the 1620s was all based on a simple observation of the world as being made up of parts, of atoms, where these parts could be exchanged and interchanged. And the way of looking at the world transformed itself from looking at the world in terms of qualities, the old Aristotelian way of looking at the world, but understanding the parts of the world. And the scientists of those days took the world apart, came up with the Cartesian method, break a problem into its parts, came up with the method of atomism, look at the constituent molecules. It was an age when the individual mattered. It was an age when concepts such as Adam Smith's economics and the autonomy of the individual purchaser came into play. It was a time when the idea of democracy and the primacy of the individual and individual rights began to take hold in Europe and across the oceans. Understand those parts, said the new rogue philosophers, and you could understand the world. And their new understanding of the world changed the world. I picked the title of my talk, 10 years After, because, of course, this is the 10th NAWEB, and we are quite literally in the period 10 years after. But also, when I thought of the phrase 10 years after, I thought immediately of Rick Hall, who, of course, has been our steward for these 10 years. And Rick Hall and 10 years after and Woodstock all form the same sort of place in my mind. The idea of peace, the idea of love, the idea of harmony, that seems to me to typify NAWEB, and it seems to typify the era into which we are now moving. 10 years after, in 1969, was 10 years after 1959. 1959 is, of course, the birth of the space age. We have Sputnik launching and then falling to the ground. We have the Luna missions. We have Explorer 6. It was also, for me, an important year. It was the year that I came into this Earth. So 10 years after means that I was 10 years old. 10 years after 1959, we reach 1969. And we have, again, a new way of looking at the world. 1969, of course, we actually leave the world and we go to another one for the first time. And what's significant is that for the first time, we see the world as a single point, as a single unit, something that you can blot out with your thumb. And we get the idea, the sort of idea that was reflected in Woodstock and the Woodstock generation, of the world as a unified whole, as one thing, as one world. 10 years ago, we saw something new happening, the emergence of the World Wide Web. And once again, it was another way of looking at the world as a unified whole, one thing, one whole. And in 10 years ago, in 1995, we are also in this era of peace, love, and happiness. Only it was e-peace, e-love, and e-happiness. There was an innocence about the World Wide Web then. There was an innocence about NAWEB then, and about online learning then. And it was captured on a web page that I don't know where it was, but it was just on the web. Captured on a web page that said simply, something wonderful is going to happen. And it was, the idea is taken from a book by Arthur C. Clarke called Childhood's End. And in Clarke's book, the something wonderful that happens is that humanity, on meeting a new alien species, begins to evolve and begins to transform itself into something new. And this is what that author was trying to capture with that message on that anonymous web page. But in 1995, we really had that sense, didn't we? We had the sense that something wonderful was going to happen. What happened was the web. And what happened with the web is that we finally got a new way of looking at the world. And it was a way of looking at the world that was as revolutionary for us as the new tools of mathematics and the new method of atomism was in the 1620s. Now, part of my talk is to talk about where things are going to go in the next 10, or more significantly, the next 100 years. And if you think about what happened in the next 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, after those wonderful days in the 1600s when Descartes was running around with algebra and Galileo was running around with the telescope, and we find that we went from this pastoral society to the age of the Industrial Revolution. We went through revolutions, nationalism, democracy, mechanized warfare, and eventually, ultimately, reaching the moon. Reaching the moon was the end of the glory days of mathematics and the beginning of the new age. And so when I look at what's going to happen in the 100 years following now, I'm looking at what we see when we see the world as a unified entity described and indeed defined by the network. As it turns out, when we start seeing the world as networks, we start seeing networks everywhere. We see networks as the structure of the brain and the neural networks. We see networks in the structure of the food web and the relations between the entities, between the fish and the frogs and the algae and so on. We see networks as types of computer systems, neural networks. We see networks in our phone systems, in our arrangement of hydroelectric power, in our highway systems, in our system of airports. Everywhere we look, there's a network. And looking at the world from the point of view of networks changes the way we look at the world just as much as looking at the world as something that we can measure, something that we can break into parts. Marshall McLuhan, in my view, was one of the first to see this. And McLuhan, of course, is famous for the saying, the medium is the message. And what McLuhan is saying in this, in my view, is that the content of the information being transmitted, whether in person, over the telephone, by television, is no more important and possibly less important than the means by which the information is transmitted. And a lot of people sort of look at that, and they look at that in the atomistic, reductionist way, and they say, okay, we must be talking about the properties of television and the properties of radio and how sound waves or light waves enhance or amplify the message. But I think that what McLuhan was after was something more direct. I think that what McLuhan was after was the nature of the connection between the sender and the receiver changes, influences, and ultimately determines the nature of the message. That the content is nothing more than the electricity, but the placement of the content in proximity to the receiver is what counts. The content is electricity, but it's the placement of the light on the ceiling that produces the effect of lighting the room. In the age of the network, it's not only the parts that are important. It's how these parts interact. Or to express it another way, it's not only the data that's important, but rather how the data interacts, how the data is processed. Or it's not only individuals that matter, it's how the individuals form communities. We're thinking and seeing of reality not simply as composed as a set of atoms, as a set of parts, but we're thinking of it and seeing reality as parts and their interactions. And we're coming to the understanding today that when you change the interactions between the parts, you change reality itself. Coal is just carbon, composed of carbon atoms. But change the way those atoms are organized, you get diamonds. Same stuff, different organization. Meaning in the old way, knowledge in the old way was pretty simple. Something was true if and only if it corresponded to the external world. Tarski's definition of truth, right? Snow is white, if and only if it is true that snow is white. Meaning and truth could be localized. They could be found in an individual person, in an individual sentence, in an individual book. In networks, information and meaning take on a different form. Meaning is no longer localized. Meaning is what we describe as distributed, where the meaning of a sentence, the meaning of a person, is found not simply in that sentence or in that person, but in the interrelationship between that sentence and that person. Knowledge on this picture, again, is not localized. It's not simply found in a dictionary or encyclopedia or in an expert or in a guru. Knowledge itself is distributed. Think about how to fly a 747, how to build and fly a 747. Who would you ask for that knowledge? It turns out there's no person that knows. Some people know how to refine and produce aviation fuel. Other people have studied and understand the principles of aerodynamics. Other people have researched and know about navigation and maps. Other people know the mechanics, the instrumentation at the front of a 747. But there's no single person, no particular locus of the information that how to fly a 747 from New York to Paris. There is no place. The knowledge itself is distributed across a network. And what makes this knowledge, what creates the knowledge of how to fly a 747, isn't just the aggregation of the individuals. It's the placement of these individuals in a network where the individual bits of knowledge can interact, can connect with each other, so that we can connect the concept of combustion with the concept of aerodynamics, with the concept of navigation. Learning in the next 100 years will be defined not from the point of view of knowledge as atoms and students as atoms and bits of learning as objects. Learning in the new age in the next 100 years will be defined according to and by the principles of the network. So for the bulk of the talk here, I'll talk about the new pedagogy, or as this is subtitled, how to pick the winners. Probably the most obvious difference between the worldview in the pre-network age and the worldview post-network is the shift from linear to multi-threaded. Linear is what you get when you use a pool cue and you strike one billiard ball, and it strikes another billiard ball. You get a nice, neat cause and effect relation, and everything is organized. Linear is what you get when you read a book, and you start at page 1, and you move through to page 375, and you read each of the pages in order. Multi-threaded is what happens when you start reading the pages of the book at random, picking page 245, then 312. And when you start reading two books at once and juxtaposing the page from one book in a page to with a page to another book. Our picture of learning today is learning as linear. Learning as structured in a course, in the course in a program. Learning as structured as beginning with lesson 1 and moving through to lesson 15. And that's what creates our unit of learning. Learning in the network age is not linear. It's not structured. It's what would be called random access, where learning is something that is accessed where needed, as needed, and the part of learning that's needed is accessed according to the situation or the context in which that learning needs to take place. We have this idea that we need to present things in a linear sequence, but in a network, there aren't linear sequences. And from the point of view of a person who inhabits a network, the world does not present itself as a linear sequence. The linear sequence, from the point of view of a person who's embedded in a network, is an abstraction, an artificial representation of reality, something that in some way conforms to the world, but in many ways does not conform to the world. In the view of a network, learning and knowledge generally moves from something that is static to something that is dynamic. The old view, the view of atoms, the view of objects, we thought of things like knowledge and information as something eternal, something unchanging. The Platonic idealism, there is one right way to see the world. There is one right way to present the information about the world. There is a static body of knowledge that we can accumulate, pile up like grains of sand. And the structures, the mechanisms that we devised in order to pass on this knowledge were also static entities. We would store knowledge in static objects like books. In today's new world of online learning, we've transferred that concept to presenting information in static bits of electronic content that we call learning objects. On the view of a network, learning isn't static that way. We shouldn't think of the bodies of knowledge and the bodies of learning as something like piles of books to be stored in a place like a library. A better metaphor is to think of learning as a resource, in the sense of water or electricity. These are things that are not static. These are things that are not heaped up in a pile, but rather they flow. We create not libraries or repositories for them. We create distribution networks, infrastructures, networks. The information that flows through these flows through freely, like water or like electricity. And from the point of view of the learner, this resource, this learning, this information is always there, like a tap at the sink in the kitchen, or like the plug on the wall, rather than something that you would have to go to and find and aggregate and collect. The new learning moves from the idea of learning content to the idea of learning as experience. The idea here is that we're moving away from the picture of education as that of the delivery of knowledge from one person to another, like boxes on a truck being moved from the factory to the consumer. Rather, the picture of learning that we're moving toward is the concept of immersion and interaction. And we see this captured already in some of the writings of people like Seymour Papert and James Paul Gee, who talk about learning environments as being structured as simulations or as games, where the experience, the context in which a person finds himself is as important, if not more important, than the content being delivered. When you move from the idea of learning as content to learning as experience, your understanding of the nature of the learning that takes place changes, because now learning, instead of being something that is shipped, is something that needs to be present in the environment, available to be used as needed, like a horse in an ecosystem, rather than like a brick in a wall. Learning in the network age moves from the principle of demonstration to the principle of inference. Learning becomes not what people are told, not what people are presented with, not what people receive as in the form of books and lessons and content, but rather learning becomes the things that they do, their interactions with the environment around them. And the learning takes place when, through these interactions, they find for themselves a way of understanding the world. They make inferences about the world based on their interactions with the world. Learning is moving from that standard of distance learning, learning objectives, to something a bit more nebulous, which I characterize as the goals of the learner. This is the idea that the locus of control is changing. In the world of atoms, in the world of objects, the objects would be aggregated, they would be uniform, they'd be thought of as a mass. Thereby we get the concept of things like elements, as in physical elements, or nations, as in groups of people all having the same properties, being organized and assembled, given a certain direction, having the same properties, the same culture, the same values. And the direction for these people would come from above, from their leaders, in a very leader-centric environment. In a network, there isn't any such thing at the top to give direction. The network isn't controlled by or directed by a leader. There is not some sort of Uber node that tells all the other nodes what to do. We have this picture of the anthill and the queen ant telling all the ants what to do. But of course, that's not how the anthill works. Each ant acts according to its own instinct and its own desires. It does the sorts of things that it wants to do. And the order that we find in an anthill is not directed by the ant queen, but rather emerges as a consequence of the individual self-directed actions of the individual ants. In the same way with learning, we do not have learning objectives that are set by a company, a government, an educational theorist. We have rather learning goals that are, or we have learning that is directed by or determined by the goals of the person doing the learning. A person does, or a person obtains learning in the context of other activities. A person is trying to figure out how to rotate a cube on a screen and thereby is led to learning about trigonometry. The goal of the learning is not to learn trigonometry. The goal of the learning is to rotate a cube. Learning becomes something that people do in order to reach their goals, as opposed to something separate from life, something separate from everything else that they do. In the network age, we move from the concept of uniformity to the concept of diversity. In a world where we thought of the world as made up of atoms, we thought of the world as being made up of basically identical, interchangeable atoms. In the world of a network, though, we can't think of the entities of the network as interchangeable. It's like cloning cats. You can replace an individual cat by cloning a cat, but when you get the identical cat in place of the first cat, what you find is that you now have a new cat, a different cat, because the cloned cat doesn't have the history, doesn't have the interactions that the previous cat had. And consequently, you cannot simply replace one part with another part. The idea of learning in the age of the network is the idea of understanding that each entity, each individual, each resource in the network is different, has its own identity, has its own way of being described. We hear an awful lot these days about standardization and about learning objects and about how all the parts should fit together and how the parts should be interchangeable. This is learning from the view of uniformity. This is the idea that you can take one thing and plug it into another. This is the idea that you can take one learner and plug that learner into the place where another learner was. But you can't do that because the relations, the connections that a learner has or a resource has with other resources or other learners makes them fundamentally different things. So that when you replace one part with another part, you actually get not a reproduction of the old thing, but something that is new. The idea that there would be one standard, one uniform way to describe all learning resources, or for that matter, all learners, is a reflection of the interpretation of the world as atoms, rather than the interpretation of the world as the network. The picture of learning that emerges is the picture of an environment where, much like today, with respect to writing, there was a time when writing was a new thing. There was a time when writing was something that was only done and only owned by the high priests and the high priestesses. And it was done in cloisters, and if you read, you would go to a special room and you'd read in the reading room. And that was before the 1620s. Writing today has changed. Writing today is the sort of thing that is wherever you need it. If you want to learn how to operate this sound system, there will be writing provided right on the sound system. If you need to figure out where to go in case of a fire, there'll be writing above that door that tells you that it's an exit. If you want to know what the news is, there's writing surrounding you that tells you what the news is. In the world where learning becomes part of an information network, learning of the future becomes like writing today, where learning is available in the future, any place you might find writing today. You buy a jar of strawberry jam. If you want to learn about strawberry jam, the learning is located within or accessible through the jar of strawberry jam. If you want to learn how to fish, you buy a new fishing rod. You cast your first cast with the fishing rod. And, well, you're just learning to fish, so it isn't very good. The fishing rod pipes up, oh, this is your first time fishing, isn't it? And then offers to train you how to fish. Bruce Sterling, in a book called Distraction, describes a group of people receiving a hotel kit. And basically the hotel kit comes with a bunch of parts, all the things necessary in order to build a hotel. And you go to the first box, and the first box says, open me. And you open the first box, and the first part says, okay, here's what you do with me. And all the different bits of a hotel teach the people how to build the hotel in progress. It's not something that they learned ahead of time, just in case they needed to know how to build a hotel. Rather, the building of the hotel and the learning how to build a hotel become one part of the same thing. It becomes one part of the unified whole. The model that I've taken to representing learning as in the network environment is the idea of learning as ecosystem. And when we think about learning resources, we need to think of learning resources not as bricks in a wall, not as sentences in a paragraph, but rather as individual items that are placed within an ecosystem, like a tree and like a horse. And we would not think about coming up with standards to define the interactivity of the tree or the horse. And we would not ask questions like, does the horse follow the tree? Or does the tree follow the horse? Rather, we're looking at a space, an environment in which these things are placed, in which these things are not simply learning by themselves, but simply part of the environment in which we live. Learning as something that we can just reach out and touch as we need it, when we need it, and where we need it. I think this is a very different picture of learning than the one we have today. And that's why I've tried to sketch it in very broad strokes. And it gets us away from the idea of courses, programs, lessons, academic institutions, government-approved curricula, corporate training, training manuals, SCORM, IMS, and the works. And it moves us toward a picture where learning is something more free-flowing, more like the innocent web that we saw in 1995, learning as the individual homepage, learning as the blog, learning as participating in an online discussion, learning as playing in an online multi-user game, learning the way the web was in 1995 when it offered the whole world in front of us and something to look forward to, kind of like 10 years after in the days of Woodstock. And I'm probably out of time, so that's my talk. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I think you know what to do with the AnyWeb pencil holder.